Today we have, last weekend we had 160 of 161 members. That's really quite remarkable. This weekend we have 160 of 161 members. In your when you picked up your tent card this morning, there was another little card attached with your name on it, and that's a kind of a ballot. And if you wish to be considered for the selection committee, which will meet sometime in July, to select the individuals or organizations that will make presentations to the assembly as a whole in the first week of September, you should take that little card and put it in the ballot box. Now, if you haven't done that yet, the ballot box has now been taken upstairs, and it's at the self-help desk. I was asked a couple of questions about that. Likely it will be in the second weekend of July, but we will poll all members to make sure as many as possible, and probably not all will be able to attend whatever date we choose. We will poll all members to choose the date that's best. It probably will be 2 days in July, probably over a weekend. In all probability, there'll be phone calls and email or stuff sent back and forth by mail, you know, packages and whatever, and then a meeting so that we can have a full two-day meeting. My hunch is we'll look at the numbers, where people are, and the cost. My hunch is the meeting will be in Vancouver, okay? Now, we'll discuss that a bit again tomorrow. We'll spend about 20 minutes on that tomorrow and clean that up and move on. Before I give a few brief announcements and report on evaluations, do we have any questions? This is our question period, if you have any. Yes, sir. Richard.
Here, now it's on. We have such harmony here. It seems to me that we should be singing in harmony and a cappella. And so I would like to sometime today have a practice of those people who are music. And we have about a quarter of this assembly are musical people. I read through all the pictures and your resumes, and there are 20, I think it was 26 musicians or people who are interested in music. So we have a good core. If we can put it together sometime today, maybe next time, we will sing without the piano and sing in harmony, four-part harmony. Does that sound weird? The rest of you would be singing as you do anyhow, and you're doing quite well, so can we try it?
So, Dick, would you like them to meet with you after dinner tonight?
After dinner tonight, I guess, would be the best time, yes, if we could. And not for Billy Graham does this. They give them half an hour, and he has 600 people singing, and they pull them together, and just astounded me. So if they can do it, I don't see why we can't do it too.
Okay, after dinner tonight, meet the Reverend downstairs with dinner. Thank you very much. Somebody asked me, by the way, what happens, do the discussion group leaders ever get together and report on what happened in their session? It's very important to know this, by the way, and Ken Carty might elaborate. Actually, after each meeting, they do get together at 1 o'clock and meet for over an hour, and they do report on what were the key developments in each of the discussion group sessions. So you should know that. Today's quote is from Brooke Bannister, attributed to the Dalai Lama, and he says, "The mind is like a parachute. It works best when it is open." Public hearings are very important, and they're very much on the minds of people, just to let you know that Leo is going to talk about that right after lunch. We've been doing some preliminary thinking about the Prince George meeting. The Prince George people have been doing a lot of thinking about the Prince George meeting. And we're going to meet with them at breakfast tomorrow, Kathy and Leo and others. But in terms of the agenda, this is where our mind is kind of at. We'll put this back on your agenda here to talk about it some more, but just so you can think about it. Three questions we think perhaps we might want to look at. One is, what did we learn in the public hearings? Number two, what have we learned from the written submissions? And number three, what should be the process for making decisions in the fall when we get together? So those are the three kinds of central questions that are in my mind, but think about that. We'll come back to it. There is an organization called the Canadian Council on Unity. It's quite a well-known, established organization with it's a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization, and they put on dinners and meetings to try and enhance the sense of being Canadian. They want to put on three dinners during the fall to tell the public more about what we're doing, one in the Greater Vancouver area, one in the islands somewhere, and one in the interior. And so they met with us or chatted with us, and so you may be invited because you can always decline, by the way, as members, but when they put one on, let's say, in the interior, they would want to invite local members of the assembly. and perhaps one of our two of us from here. So we said, sure, just like the Rotary, any other organization can ask us to do these things. Just like any organization, Lee, you can say no if you don't wish to go, or you can say yes. Anyway, I thought I'd let you know that. The cartoon, the caricature done by Chuck Walker last week, and he's got another one this week, by the way, it features Ken. Ken, actually, I think it's flattering. And Campbell. And it's actually a very good one. It actually flatters you more than it flatters me. And this is now on our website, and you can pull it down. It's in color. How am I doing? A few more minutes here. There's a lot of public interest across the country in what we're doing. Indeed, we have some visitors here, a visitor here from the United States. There's a lot of interest in what we're doing. Ken Carty has been giving a lot of talks to public policy groups, political science groups. Last week I gave a talk to the Public Policy Forum in Ottawa. One of our members, Jack McDonald, was so worried about what I might say, he sent his son to listen to me. I also had the opportunity last week to meet Andre Blais's graduate students. Remember, Andre Blais was here last weekend. He's in Montreal. I met his graduate students and the faculty that worked there, and it was a very enjoyable morning. We've been asked, by the way, by someone or maybe a couple of members, if we would give the names of the assembly members who are going to be attending specific public hearings, and we said no. Okay, I'd like to make a few comments on the evaluation survey of last week. Again, this is nothing but great news. There are 19 questions, as you know, on your survey, and then you have things you can write in. What do you like best? What do you like least? We all read every one of them, by the way. Actually, we get printouts from our evaluator, so we don't know what any particular one person said, but we read every comment. On January 11, the first time, of a total possible score of 5.0, that is everybody rated everything 5, which is never heard of before, we had 4.47. We were so thrilled that the members rated it that well that we just couldn't believe that it could ever get better. Well, the second week it was 4.53. What do you do? Last week, 4.65. I mean, you know, pretty soon somehow you will defy mathematical probabilities and you'll be 5.5. Now, what you are rating highest is also very encouraging. Coming in together there is, I am looking forward to the next session, 4.88. That was almost everybody is rating that number 5. And equally, and I think I'm going to talk about this just slightly, a little bit later, a couple minutes, equally rated with that was, I feel the work of the Citizens Assembly is important. I think that tells you one reason why I think this has been successful is. Also related high in the discussion groups, everybody is treated with respect and we value our opinions. And also very high again, Citizens Assembly staff is ready, available, and very helpful. Now, of the comments about what we like least and best, we pick up a lot of things from that, by the way. A lot of people suggested Pepsi instead of Coke and things of that sort. Sometimes we don't move real rapidly on those suggestions, but there are others. The most frequent criticisms, basically of me, a few individuals monopolize question period a little bit more than others, and would the chair be a little bit more disciplined? Well, I will try to be, okay? And if I feel that you're going on a little bit too much, I might kind of give you the time sign or whatever, okay? In terms of the most frequently mentioned like items, it was Andre Blais's presentation. That was really well liked. About 30 people, he said, that's probably what they like best this time around. Overall, lots of satisfaction with the discussion groups. The session of working with media was greatly appreciated. Members want to help get people out to the public hearings. And Leo's going to talk about this a bit, and I think in the following week we're going to have a short session on how we can all help each other get members out to the public hearings. One person, I asked you to note whether or not you like singing the national anthem, and one person wrote in, yes, I like singing the national anthem. It gives me a great honor. Mary, thank you very much for that comment. And many quotes like the following. It's most heartening. Quote, most members are really pulling together. And another one, unquote, the members of my discussion group are the best ever, unquote. Why is it going so well? Well, I'm going to give you that in about 2 minutes. As a matter of fact, a couple of talks that I've given recently, I give six or seven reasons why I think we're doing very well. The number one reason I give, and I mean it so sincerely, I think it is because of the quality and the commitment of the members of the assembly. And if you remember how we were all chosen, at least all 160 members, we all talk about being randomly selected. You know, that's only a part of it. We were randomly invited, right? 200 people per constituency got a letter. The second phase, I don't think I have given sufficient attention, and perhaps others. There was self-selection. There was a period of self-selection. So for every 200 letters that went out about, Leo, you can correct me if I'm wrong, about 17 people said yes. About every 200 letters that went out. That self-selection process was really, really critical. Then of those 17 that came to the meeting, of course, then we chose one man and one woman. So randomization took place again. But that self-selection process, I think, is a great contributor to the quality and the commitment of the members that we have, because a whole bunch of people, of course, said no. The people said yes, as we can tell by their profiles, are people who are really committed to their community. You tell, look at, they're very much involved in community affairs and people who really cared a lot about British Columbia. So self-invited you were and randomly selected out of the hat in the end. But that whole period of self-selection, I think, is very, very important to the quality and the commitment of these members. So that's the kind of thing I tell them when I go to Ottawa. We've got a lot to learn this weekend, so it is my pleasure to turn it over to Ken Carty.
I'm not sure. Thank you, Jack. I'm not sure if the screen is working this morning. We had the words for O Canada up, and only I could see them on the computer here. They didn't get on this. Oh, here we go. Okay. Well, we've got some complicated systems to talk about this weekend, or at least systems that look complicated. And they look complicated partly because we don't know them. We don't have experience with them. We're not familiar with them. But what we want to do, of course, is focus on the basic principles. What are they about? What are they trying to do? How do they kind of go about accomplishing that? And if one of these systems was to strike assembly members' fancy, then working through the kind of technical details we can get to. We'll have to talk a little bit about that, but the important thing is to kind of get some sense of what they're about and what they do and what they don't do and what their strengths and weaknesses are in terms of the kind of way we've been going about it up till now. We're going to talk about proportional representation, so-called list systems this morning. We're going to talk about the single transferable vote forms of proportional representation this afternoon, and we're going to talk about so-called mixed systems, which try and mix the best or the worst, depending on how you look at it, elements of different families together tomorrow. So that's kind of what we're going to do. We'll try and get through it, and feel free to stop me if you've got questions about that. Okay, so let's start by looking at the basic principles that underline proportional representation list systems. And I guess one thing we need to keep in mind is that these are systems about political parties. These are systems designed to give political parties a share of seats that reflects the share of votes that they have. So the idea of these systems is somehow to decide how many seats a political party gets. The kind of electoral system we're used to is about electing individuals in individual districts. The focus is on individuals. These are systems that focus on political parties first. We'll come in and talk about how candidates get involved, but the party is at the center of these kinds of systems. So we want to think about them in which the people contesting the elections are not individuals, they're not candidates, they're not the people who are actually going to, in the end, get elected, but the baseline, the fundamental contestants who are engaged in the contest are the political parties, our organizations. So these are systems designed to distribute seats to political parties in the legislature. Then the question of who fills those seats, that's a kind of second-order question, which is the reverse of the kind of systems we're used to, where the first-order question is who should we elect, and then how they're connected to political parties is another issue. So it's about political parties, but about political parties in a special way, in a way that's designed to make sure that the share of the seats they get is more or less proportional to the share of the votes. And I say more or less proportional because no system is likely to be exactly perfect. If you get 10.936% of the votes, you're not likely to get 10.936% of the seats. They don't work out that perfectly. But the idea is if you get about 10% of the votes, you should get about 10% of the seats. That's the underlying principle that's involved here. So we want to keep that in mind as really the essence of what we're talking about. So let's talk about then the three key elements. Remember, we identified three key elements in most political systems: district magnitude, that is the size of districts. We talked about the formulas, and we talked about ballot structure. Let's start with district magnitude. Well, it has to be bigger than one. You can't share one seat between two parties, or three parties, or four parties. So the electoral district from which the representatives come and come into the legislature has to be more than one. And it can't be any bigger than the size of the whole legislature, but it could be that big. You could have a district magnitude in which the whole legislature was just simply one district. So technically, I suppose, in British Columbia, it could range anywhere, therefore, from 2 to 79. If it was only 2, you wouldn't get much sharing, because only 2 people could share, 2 parties, not 3 or 4, or all the 41 that are on our registration. If it were 79, you can obviously share that more. So the size is going to make a difference. In most proportional representation systems, it's not necessary at all for the various parts of the country or the province out of which representatives come from to be the same size. So in fact, it's actually generally quite unusual for district magnitudes all to be the same. We might have Vancouver Island as one area, and it would have so many seats, it may be Vancouver, and then you might have different numbers of seats. So you could divide the province up in different kinds of ways if you wanted. The idea wouldn't be that they would necessarily need to have the same number of representatives because the vote shares would work out. Our system, we're used to, of course, one in which the district magnitudes are basically the same. You know, they're one pretty much across the province. And proportional representation systems often work in kind of levels. The technical term is tiers. I think David Farrell uses tiers, the term in his book. So that sometimes what you want to do is distribute votes at a kind of big district level, but then save some of the seats for a kind of second level of distribution so that you can kind of adjust the proportionality. So you might imagine a two-tier system in British Columbia. There might be, say, Vancouver Island, the Lower Mainland, the Okanagan, the Eastern Southeast, and the North, or something like that as the first kind of range. And then you might save some over for the province as a whole. So you could have kind of levels piled on top, which you'd allocate some of the seats at the first level, and then save some of them for the second level. And those levels can be different. So you could have different magnitudes. So already you can begin to see that the kind of permutations and combinations are going to start to grow. So that's, in some sense, the story of what district magnitude is about. And it's very unlike the kind of system we have. District magnitudes are different, they're bigger, and they vary quite a lot across systems. And we'll talk about some examples. And some proportional representation systems want to make that even more complicated by saying, well, at the second tier, we won't actually assign a fixed number of seats. We'll leave that kind of variable so that we can adjust to get to proportionality at the end of the day. And so some of the systems have a kind of undefined number of kind of top-up seats available, which, of course, means that the legislature may be a little bit bigger, a little bit smaller from time to time. Okay, so that's the district magnitude question, the basic unit out of which seats are going to be allocated into the legislature. The second question, and here we get into the, I suppose, complications, if you like, is the business of formula. How do you actually decide how many votes produce how many seats for a particular political party? And there are large numbers of variations that people have devised, and it's essentially a mathematical problem. The mathematics of this are such that there are, in the systems that now exist out there in a number of countries, two basic ways of doing it. One is the so-called largest remainder system, or what we might call quota systems, in which you make a mathematical calculation as how many votes does it take to get a particular seat. And there are different kinds of quotas. There's hair quotas and droop quotas and other kinds of quotas. You may have read about some of those in David's chapter. But basically, there's a mathematical formula that calculates a quota, how many votes you need, and let's say it's 1,000. And you say, well, how many votes did Party 1 have? Well, Party 1 had 3,000, so you divide. They have three quotas. They have three times as many as you need for one seat, so they get three seats. And Party 2 might have 5,000 votes, so they have equivalent of five quotas. And you can kind of work through the logic. And they're called last remainder systems because by the time you finish this out, there might be a seat or two left over that no one's quite made the quota. And you just simply give that last seat to the person who gets closest to the quota, who has the largest remainder of seats left. So these are the quota kinds of systems, and they tend to be advantageous to smaller parties. We lost the screen. Oh, we lost this screen, but not that screen. That's strange. So maybe we can work at it. So that's one group of mathematical formulas. As I say, you don't need to worry too much about it, but I think it's important to know the range of possibilities. The second are what are called the largest average systems. And they're systems where you essentially divide the number of votes parties have by a series of numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then work through how many votes parties have on each of these series of mathematical calculations. And the parties that have the largest numbers, that have the largest average at any one particular set of divisions, wins those seats. And there are some quite simple but helpful, I think, examples in Farrell that compare the two kinds using a red, green, blue kind of party and only five candidates and so on. And there you give seats to parties with the highest average vote. Well, at the end of this morning, we'll look at some of those comparisons to show how much or how little difference they make. It's only to say that there's a wide range of possibilities and different systems use them in all kinds of combinations because these have to get combined with all the possible combinations of district magnitudes that we talked about. Okay, it's starting to pile up, right? On balance, the lower remainder systems are probably better for small parties than are the largest average ones. That means they're more likely to get a seat at the end of the day, at the end of the count. Now, the smallest parties are often hoping to get one or two seats at the very end if they've only got 2, 3, 5% of the vote. Are they going to get any seats or not? And so the smallest parties do a little bit better under the systems that use quotas than not. And they actually do better when the quotas are bigger than when they're smaller. That's a kind of mathematical anomaly. We could talk about if people really were desperate to find out about why that should happen. The other thing that's worth saying, well, you should know the truth in advertising, is that if you've got different levels at which seats are allocated, remember I said there's tiers, and you might have Vancouver Island and Vancouver and the interior, and then Vancouver as a whole, you might use different formulas at these different levels. And lots of systems do say, well, at the first level of assignment, we're going to use a hair quota. But at the second level, we're going to use a Saint-Légu divisor because they think that they have different kinds of effects. The effects are small, but very often they'll have a more proportional kind of counting system at the first level, and then at the top up have a system that really kind of helps the largest parties a little bit, so they might be a bit stronger in the legislature. So that's only to say that you can combine these things in almost as many ways as you have imagination to do so. So different formula can be used at different levels. It's also possible under these kinds of systems to, let's say that you've run a small party and you didn't get quite enough votes at the first level to get a seat. Well, sometimes it's possible then to use to save these votes and use them at the second set of calculations, the second level. And so they can be pooled. And so if you didn't win enough seats in Vancouver Island or Vancouver, and you've got lots of kind of unused votes, you can kind of use them up at the second kind of calculation. That's a term that's often called perlement, and it's a kind of vote pooling. So, again, it's a way of trying to complicate these kinds of arrangements. Now, most proportional representation systems saying, well, on principle, we want to make the results as proportional as possible. That's really to give smaller parties a chance, the kind of chances they don't get in plurality systems. But, you know, we really don't want the nuisance parties in there, or the extremist parties, or the parties that got only 1% of the vote. And if they get one or two seats in a legislature, they'll just be a nuisance, and they're not going to contribute anything. So why don't we have a threshold? And thresholds are often exist in which they say, well, despite however the formula works out, you've got to get 2% or 5% or 8% or something before you get any seats. So you've got to kind of pass that minimum test before you're entitled to anything. Once you pass it, you're fine. And so that means that votes for people who don't get past the threshold just simply are not going to contribute to electing anybody. So it's a kind of way of saying, well, we want proportionality, but we don't want proportionality for some of these smallest or extremists or whatever groups. And different countries have adopted them with different kind of rationales. And as you would expect, there's lots of different kinds of thresholds. You can have thresholds at the first level or at the second level or at both levels. You can have thresholds of different sizes. Most of them run in the 2 to 5% range. The Germans use 5%. I think the Swedes use 4%. So in that kind of territory. And you can have actually different kinds of thresholds as well. You can have a kind of percentage threshold. But some countries say, well, you actually have to get, you have to win one of the local level seats or the first level seats before you can are entitled to any of the proportional seats. So there's different kinds of thresholds. But they're all variations on the theme of, is there some way in which we can kind of limit perhaps the very smallest groups to sharing in this kind of principle. Okay, so now we've gotten through the problem of district magnitude. Lots of possibilities, lots of variations. The formula, lots of possibilities, lots of variations, and you can see they're all going to be combined. The third key element of an electoral system, of course, that we've talked about is the ballot structure. What's the ballot paper look like that voters have to deal with when they get at the polling place? Well, the ballot papers are designed fundamentally to allow voters to choose between lists of candidates. That's why they're called party list systems. And sometimes they'll have all the candidates running in that area listed, or perhaps they'll just have the top two or three candidates listed on the ballot paper, but the others will have been circulated in advance. And the principle is you're voting for the list, and that the candidates who get elected will come off of that list. And the way they come off it, of course, there's lots of possibilities, lots of combinations there as well. But the thing to remember is that however you mark the ballot paper, what you're really doing is voting for a list in one way or another. Well, a very common kind of list are what are called closed lists. That is, you've got a list of, let's say, 10 names of the district magnitude. Let's say we had a PR system and Greater Vancouver was one basic level and there was 10 or 15 people to be elected. You'd have a list of 15 names for each party and you would tick it off. If it was a closed list and your party got, let's say, half the votes, first half of the candidates on that list would get elected. You start at the top and you work your way down. And about as far down as you got, and those would be chosen. So the party vote would decide how many candidates you got. Then the way the list was organized would determine who got to fill those seats that the party had won. The party wins the seats. The question is, who gets to fill them? Well, that's easy and clear. You know, you've got a list, and you just keep going down the list, ticking off till you run out of seats to fill. But then there are open lists. And they say, well, we shouldn't let the parties decide so rigidly, so maybe we had them an open list where voters can indicate which of the candidates on the party's list they like, and that should influence in some way. Well, there are combinations of doing that, too. Let's keep our options open, I guess. The Belgians use a system in which you can go down the list and tick off a candidate's name if you like. Or you can just tick the party's list. So you choose one or the other. Everybody who ticks the party list is just assumed that they're voting for the list in the order that they're on the ballot paper. People who tick a particular individual are really saying, I want this person put first. And so let's say that a party gets 5 seats, and the question is, did someone farther down the list than below the 5 position have enough ticks to overcome all the ones that didn't indicate a preference. In those systems, mostly people just tick the party. And so ticking a candidate is satisfying for individuals, but rarely makes much of a difference because all the party ticks just go to the guys or the women on the top of the list. The Finns have a different system. The Finns have a system in which you get lists of candidates and you can't tick for the party. You can only tick for a candidate. You can tick for one candidate on all those lists. Now, you would think, well, that's a kind of vote for the candidate. But first of all, it's counted as a vote for the party to decide whether the party's going to get any seats or not. And so all the ticks for all the candidates in a given party are added up, and they say, okay, that's how many votes that party has. That's where we start. That's the fundamental principle. And we're going to count those up, and we're going to use that through our formula to decide how many seats that party has. And after we've decided, then we're going to go and count the individual ticks and see which of the candidates got the most of them. And so in some sense, that allows the voters to change the order of the list and to determine really the order of the list. But they're not really voting for candidates. They're really voting for a party because the party might win no seats or might win lots of seats. And that depends on not how many people vote for the candidate, but how many people vote for all the candidates on a given list. Well, in Switzerland, they say, well, we can make that more complicated. We can give people more than one vote so they can vote for candidates and parties on different lists. And we can have a way of kind of sorting all that out. But again, counting the party votes first and working out the allocations of the seats and then calculating preferences. It's also possible on ballot structures that while a party may decide that it's going to have one national list, that they're going to be kind of organized by region. The Dutch have a system in which the country is one big district. There's only one district in the Netherlands. It's 150 seats. And so there's a list of the 150 names. But in fact, the list is broken up into various regions. And so when the candidates are actually assigned to fill the seats the party might win, they come from different regional lists on a national list. So again, it's possible to combine them in that kind of way. So there's a wide range of possibilities on these kinds of things. This might be a time to stop. I mean, it covered a huge amount of possibilities and combinations on these three elements. Really suggests you can kind of almost organize them how you like. You can organize the district magnitudes. The larger it gets, the more proportional it's going to be possible to make the system. The formulas vary amongst themselves, but all basically designed to produce a kind of proportional outcome. And ballot structures are designed in lots of ways to give the voters more or less marginal influence in who gets to fill those kind of seats. Anybody have any questions about any of these? Oh, gosh, okay. Gladys.
Yes, Ken. There's one word that I read in the book and I keep hearing, and the word disturbs me because people are going to take it the wrong way, and that's a two-tier system. And as soon as you say two-tier, they think it's unequal and discriminatory, things like that.
Yeah, a level is another word, a two-level system. Tier is just simply a word that's been used in the political science literature and in legal descriptions of these things. And as I said, basically, it's a way of saying, well, we're going to have most of the seats organized in a series of districts of varying size, but we're going to save a few over to kind of make some final adjustments to the top. It's a kind of two-level system.
Yes, Ken.
Hi, Sean.
Is there a formula or a suggested number of voters that should go towards representing one candidate or sitting member or whatever that will suggest more proportional representation or less? Like, can it get too large a number of voters per sitting member?
The number of voters per sitting member may well influence the relationship between voters and sitting members, but the real question of proportionality comes down to the issue of district magnitude. how many members come from an area which has some seats assigned to it. Let's say Vancouver Island was an area. You could make it more proportional if it had 10 members than if it only had 5, because you can share out 10 among 10 different parties. You can only share out 5 among 5 different parties. So the more members you can elect from whatever the basic unit is, the first tier, first level, Gladys, the more proportional the outcome can be. And of course, sometimes it gets too proportional. They say, well, that's a little too proportional. We better have a threshold to kind of stop people at the bottom. Legislatures vary enormously in size. The number of people in the system to the number of members of the legislature they have varies enormously, and those reflect different traditions and histories. Just like the size of legislatures in Canada, from province to province, vary quite a lot in terms of how many politicians there are per voter. But that particular number doesn't necessarily enter into it. It's probably true that when legislatures get quite small, then the kind of range of options you have begin to shrink, because just possible district magnitudes begin to shrink, and the combinations you have get a bit more awkward. I mean, if you're trying to devise a three-tier system with a minimum threshold and the Haunt divisors in the Prince Edward Island legislature of 32 members, you would get into all kind of difficulties. Big national legislatures where some of these systems work, you have a bigger range of possibilities. And we are working with a legislature of about 79. One or two more, and then we'll move on. Rob and then Harley. Rob.
Yes. Quick question about the Finland situation. You said that it is voting for the candidate, but it gives a party signal. Does the candidates that gets the most vote get voted, get elected? And on the Netherlands system, does that system provide some sort of regionality, while like regional representation, while using a national list, basically?
On the first question, in the Finnish system, people all vote for a particular candidate. Whether the candidates will get elected or not depends on how many votes all the candidates in that party got. So if you add up all the votes for all the candidates in party one, and if they're entitled to 5 seats, then the candidates with the 5 most votes are the ones that get elected. But whether any of them get elected or not depends on not only their vote, but all the votes for all the other candidates in their party, because you have to decide the party's the real contestant and how many they get to start with. In the Netherlands, they treat the country as one big unit, but they say, well, we want to make sure we've got some members from the north and the south and the east and the west, so we are going to have so they will come off these regional lists, so that at least some of the people coming into the parliament come from different regions. That's exactly why they do it. Harley?
I'm just trying to relate to the size of government with proportional representation. Like, we have 79 ridings in B.C., is there a history showing that there is a good number of ridings or members that works? Or, like in BC, would we have to increase that number? Or
To run a proportional representation system, we wouldn't have to. The size might influence whether you wanted tiers and how many tiers you might want it, and what the district magnitudes might be. But the total size ought not to influence it. It's more like it influenced individual decisions on some of these technical questions we've been talking about, and would probably make some of them less practical than others, I think is the fairest way to answer that. Well, so designing a PR system, the kind of thing that both Rob and Harley have just really been asking about, requires making a series of decisions. First decisions are about districts and the size of districts from which members are going to come. What size should they be? How many of them should there be? Should there be tiers? Should there be levels or just one level? What are you using those tiers for? And you can use them in a different way. You can use them to kind of scoop up the unused votes at the first level. You could use them to provide for a more proportional result. You could use them as a kind of to supplement what's going on at the first level, and different countries use those things in different ways. For instance, in the Czech Republic, votes that aren't counted at the first level are saved, and then they're transferred over to the second level where they can be used, so that's going to help small parties who didn't get enough at the first level in a particular district, but they have enough in a number of different districts that they might combine them. The Swedes use the second level to kind of make sure the final totals kind of work out proportionally. In Poland, they use it's just a kind of another level in which something else is going on to supplement it. But here are four kinds of examples, just to give you an idea of the kind of range of things that are out there. Austria has 183 members of its national parliament. 13 of them are in a second level. And they might be 13, they might be 12, they might be 14. It's a little bit of a, it's a kind of soft number. It's a variable number. It's not fixed because they're using it to kind of do some compensations to balance things out at the last minute. So they've got basically nine basic units in the country, nine districts, and they have two at this kind of second tier level. And the district magnitudes of these, of the basically 170 basic seats, 183 minus the 13 at that second level, they range from as small as 6 to as large as 39. And they reflect really historical units in Austria. You know, Vienna is one area, and then other regionals are other areas, and you simply adjust the number of members from these different regions of the country in terms of their population. So they can be relatively small or relatively large. In a district that's 39, you can get almost perfect proportionality. In a district that's 6, will depend on the number of parties running. On average, they're about 20.3. So they're running a party list system where the average district magnitude is about 20, but there's a big range around that. The Belgians run a parliament with 212 members. 7 of them are kind of these varied top-up kinds of members, or it can vary around 7. They've got about 30 districts and 9 units at the second level in which they can make allocations. Some of their districts are tiny, only 2. Others are quite large, 33. Their average is about 7, and so on. The Danes, you can see, have 175. 40 of them, that's a pretty big proportion, are at a second tier. And there's only one tier. It's a kind of national second tier leveling up. So they've got 23 basic districts in which the 135 members are distributed, and then at the second level, 40. They range from as small as 2 up to 15, an average of about 6, 5.9. And the Spaniards have 350. They have 52 districts. They have some tiny districts, even one of just one. There's not going to be anything proportional about that district. But they have some as large as 33, and on average is about almost 7, 6.7. So you can see that there's enormous kinds of ranges and possibilities in making decisions. They reflect decisions about the size, where they should be, how many of them there should be, whether there should be some kind of tiers, how they can be, how they ought to be used. So there's lots of possibilities to achieve different kinds of goals in these kind of processes. And they're to reflect regional realities. They're to reflect different notions of proportionality. You have to decide when you're designing a system what kind of formula you want. Which formula? Do you want to, you know, the largest remainder or largest average kind of formula? And there's a range of them. Do you want to use the same formula at both levels, or do you want to use different formulas at different levels so they work a little bit differently? And if you're going to use a quota system, well, which quota? A big quota or a small quota? Bigger quotas help smaller parties, and smaller quotas help bigger parties. It's one of those mathematical oddities. And so who are you trying to help? Do you want a threshold? If so, what kind and where it ought to be? And ballot structures. Do you want it closed or open? And if open, and how? So all those kind of things have to go into decisions about putting a list system together. And in the materials that came around today, it's a version of a table you saw last week, which is just a kind of summary of all the different combinations that are quite common in Europe. And you can see that there's lots of them that are just kind of unique, but that in fact out on the final column here, we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12 basic different kind of systems, and there's more than 12, because then there's questions about how open and closed the lists are and how proportional and so on they are. So it just gives you a sense of the kind of range of possibilities and the variations that you're playing with. But all designed basically to kind of come to the same thing at the end. Well, it's probably fair to say that larger systems produce better proportionality. That's a fundamental principle that we have talked about a little bit already this morning. More than one tier, more than one level is more likely to help smaller parties because it provides them, in some sense, a second crack at the can. It provides them a way of using, maybe pooling votes and using votes that didn't get them any seats elected the first time. We know that the largest remainder systems, and the hair quota to be about, is the most proportional. Other combinations are much less proportional. But those differences, as we'll see, are still modest compared to some of the differences between all these systems and plurality systems. So that whatever these variations, and these variations all exist for kind of idiosyncratic reasons, they make much less difference amongst themselves than they do as a group compared to the kind of systems that we have and talked about last week, majority or plurality systems. Closed lists are designed to maintain good control of the membership and the assembly by the party leadership. I mean, whoever controls that list has an enormous influence on the careers of the politicians. If you want to get elected, you really have to be relatively high on the list, unless it's a completely open list like the Finns. So whoever decides who's on the list to start with, never mind how hard they are on it, is going to have enormous kind of control and power in those kinds of organizations. So parties are going to be more centralized. People are going to be more deferential to people who can kind of control those kinds of lists. It's more likely to be focused in a few people. And these are systems that are going to have much more limited voter-politician connections, because individual politicians know that the most important thing is for their party to get votes, not for them to get votes. And if they're in a district where there are 39 other people being elected anyway, the connection between them and any individual voter is not likely to make much difference to anybody, and certainly not to them. And so their kind of connections to voters are very different. They're much less personal. They're much less direct than systems where individual candidates are coming to voters and asking for their support in a one-on-one basis. Those are generalish propositions, but I think that they're a way of kind of summarizing how some of these things are working. Well, I just thought it would be useful to kind of look at four places because, you know, we read in the Penticton paper that proportional representation produces unstable parliaments and it's bad. And in some places it may have. In other places it hasn't worked like that at all. So here are simply four examples that I thought might be useful or interesting, because they cover a bit of a variation in different parts of Europe where these systems have been used for some real length of time, and so there's some experience. The Israeli case is interesting. It's a system in which the whole country is one district. There are 120 members of the Knesset. They use a largest average Dehaene system for figuring out how many seats a party can get. So that's the arrangement they use. They have a threshold of 1.5%. If you don't get 1.5% of the vote, you get no seats. But if you get 1.5%, you're in. And it's a closed list. You vote for the party, and they simply take the names off the top in terms of the number of seats they win. Well, in the 2003 general election that was just recently held, 13 parties ended up winning seats in the parliament. The largest party got 29% of the vote. So you have an image of a parliament that's pretty fractured. 13 different parties in the parliament, the largest one having just under 30% of the vote. But in some sense, of course, that reflects a good deal of the divisions of an Israeli society. What they've done is designed a system to say, look, there's all these divisions out there. Let's try and bring them into the parliament, and we'll see if they can all have some kind of voice in what goes on. Well, the Dutch also have a system which is one big countrywide district. Their district magnitude is 150. There's 150 members of the Dutch parliament. They use, like the Israelis, a largest average Dehaene system. They have a smaller threshold, You have to get 1/150th, which is 0.6, 2/3% of the vote gets you a seat in the Dutch parliament. They use a preferential list system, so voters have at least a little possibility of indicating some preference to people on the list. And they're allocated by regions to try, they have a regionalized list to try and at least make sure that there are people from different parts of the pretty small country. In the recent election in 2003, 9 parties got elected to the Dutch parliament. For many years, there used to be a 5-party consortium that ran Holland. It's fragmented a little bit, and there's now a number of smaller parties. The largest party got 29% of the vote. And once the election was over, it took them 3 months to form a government because there was a range of different possibilities. There was 9 parties there. The largest one only had less than a third of the vote. And so the numbers of combinations of parties and arrangements that would get them to a majority were more than one. And so there was lots of negotiation and bargaining. They spent about 3 months, which was pretty good. I mean, the Dutch have a history of taking 6-7 months sometimes. The governments are very stable, very effective once they're formed, but they involve a fair amount of inter-party bargaining to come together and form that coalition, and those coalitions tend to work. That's been their practice. Well, the Swedes use a 2-tier system, 2-level system. The second level is to provide for some kind of correction, to make sure that the whole thing is kind of proportional at the national level. They use the largest average system. They don't use the DeHaan divisors, they use the Stanley Gew divisors. They have 2 different kinds of thresholds, either 4% nationally or 12% in one of the districts. So there's 2 different ways that you can get into the share out of seats. But you've got to pass one or other of those thresholds or you can't participate. And they use a preferential list system. Well, in the 2002 general election, the most recent Swedish general election, 7 parties passed that threshold and got some seats in the parliament, but the largest one of them got over 40% of the vote, was able to form a government relatively easily. So just because you have proportional representation doesn't mean you automatically are going to get a fragmentation in the legislature. It depends on the strength of the parties out there. And the Swedish Social Democrats have been a big dominant party in that country for a very long time, and they continue to be so. You don't necessarily get the kind of Israeli fragmentation. You get a different kind of pattern because that reflects what's going on out in the country. The Austrian case is another example. They've got 3 tiers, 3 levels. They've got enormous variation in their district magnitudes. They use a quota system with the hair quota. They have a threshold of 4% nationally or winning 1 local district seat somewhere. The Swedes use a percentage in the local districts. They simply say, well, if you can get 1 seat in one of the districts, then you can share out. In the 2002 general election, only 4 parties got elected. So proportional representation didn't produce a huge increase in the number of parties. It did allow a couple of the smaller parties in. The largest party had about 40-some percent of the vote. The second largest party almost had 40% as well. It's a big 2-party system that's been there since the Second World War. But it allows for a couple of smaller parties to get in. But because nobody won a majority, there were still a number of possibilities around coalitions at the end. It took them 3 months to form a government after the election. It wasn't clear, and so there was a period of inter-party bargaining. So you see, there's quite a range of different kinds of experiences here, and they reflect a fair amount of what's going on in those kinds of societies. And that's precisely what they're designed to do. But in all cases, proportional representation does tend to lead to multi-party politics. It allows more parties to compete, gives more parties hope of getting elected. Almost all proportional representation systems therefore end up with coalition governments, because voters very rarely in any system give a majority of their votes to just one party. We get majority governments in our system, as we've seen, because the system produces them. But these systems don't produce them, and so they get coalition governments and a fair amount of parliamentary bargaining to form the governments. Okay, well, now we want to try and look at some of these systems in terms of our criteria, our so-called evaluation criteria. Predictable governments. PR systems generally produce coalition governments. They increase the number of political parties competing, the number of political parties winning seats, and therefore the they reduce the chance of majority, so they produce coalitions. It's not always clear to voters before the election who is likely to be in the coalition. They can vote for their party and hope their party will have that much influence in the parliament, but what position is likely to be in the government or opposition balance will depend on the strength of other parties and the kinds of arrangements they can make. These governments can often be very stable, very effective, and there's a panoply of experience across Europe to indicate that. Governments can sometimes take some time after elections to form them, as parties do engage in that kind of bargaining process. And in general, coalitions don't last as long as single-party majority governments. And if you're to look at the historical experience over the last century, compare coalition governments and single-party majority governments, coalition governments don't last as long. For some people, that's a good thing, get them out. Others think, well, you know, longer governments have more time to plan. There's a little bit more stability in that kind of arrangement. But there's quite a variation from country to country. So we might say it gets a kind of moderate score. It doesn't have the kind of predictability and longevity of plurality governments. But they don't generally do too badly, but it's quite variable. Electoral accountability. Well, because they produce coalitions and multi-party politics, it's very difficult often for voters to hold particular parties responsible for what the government is doing. If you have three parties in a coalition, and you come to the election and you can get to vote for one of those parties or some other party, it's difficult to say, well, I like what the coalition government did, so I'm going to vote for that particular party to kind of reward it and hope it gets back in, because it might be a different kind of coalition after. Or if you don't like some of the things the government did, you could say, well, I'm going to vote against them. But who is it you vote against? It's not necessarily so clear. So that kind of clarity of accountability lines is not the same as in the kind of systems we're perhaps more familiar with. We know that voters, as individuals, have very little capacity to influence the individuals that tend to get elected. They come off the party list, and they tend to be controlled by that. And even where voters have some possibility of indicating preferences on lists, the number of people chosen will really depend more on the party's success than on any candidate's success. So there's not much of that direct personal accountability. Really, elections are opportunities for people to indicate their preferences. What do they support? What are they against? We support a party that's for this or for that, rather than the kind of elections that say, here's a choice, you can have this or that as your government, take one or the other. You can have New Democrats or Liberals. In PR systems, you can kind of vote for one party, knowing it's going to be part of a bargaining process and a coalition kind of formation. So that's the kind of elections as preference expressing, rather than elections as choosing, to make a kind of crude distinction. Process. It's probably also fair to say that in proportional representation systems, shifts tend to be quite gradual. There's not nearly, if you've got a number of parties all with a kind of well-identified clientele, they tend to focus at election time in getting their votes out rather than converting. You know, there's not a big incentive for politicians to go out and try and convert opposition parties' voters to their cause. Because let's say you spend all your energy trying to convert your opponents and you get 1 or 2% of them to come over to your side, it's not going to make much difference. And it might offend some of your own supporters because you're paying attention to your opponents. In our kind of system, there's big rewards for trying to convert people because a few conversions can actually change the seat because it's a kind of winner-take-all sort of system. So there are different in systems, different incentives. And so these are systems that tend to be much more gradual in the kind of electoral swings over time that exist. It provides a different kind of stability, perhaps. On balance, one might say that by comparison to the other systems, and these judgments, you know, we agreed last week, it would all be kind of pretty general and comparative. Parliamentary check on government. Well, we know that's good because we know that in coalition governments, it's the parliamentary bargains that decide who's in government, and if the members of parliament decide that they don't like what the government's doing, they can vote them out and create a different kind of coalition. So there's an accountability to the parliament and to the members of parliament in these systems that's much greater than in systems where one party have a majority and pretty much ram things through and do as they like. So there's a kind of much greater possibility for a check on on governments. There are systems that often force the prime minister to share more power. The prime minister may be a party leader, but there are other parties in his coalition, and they all have leaders, and they all have interests in protecting their parties and their parties' interests, and the power of those party leaders who bring their parties with them to the coalition is a way of balancing, in some sense, the power of the prime minister. So, in some sense, even within cabinets, there's more of a sharing out of power. And, in fact, in some coalition governments, often it's not a party leader at all that becomes a prime minister. Because one party says, well, we'll go into coalition with you, but we don't like your leader. He said nasty things about us at the election, but we could stand for somebody else in your party to become the prime minister. And so sometimes you get systems in which prime ministers emerge out of a kind of party bargaining process, which is none of the party leaders. So then you've got a prime minister and several party leaders in the cabinet. So you've got multiple centers of power and balance in some ways. And these all provide ways to provide some kind of working checks on governments. Role of members, we talked about that a little bit as one of the criteria. Of course, members of these systems are largely free of the day-to-day worries about constituents because they don't have them in some sense. The parties have supporters, the politicians have obligations to the parties, but they don't have them the same to constituents, so they're not connected. So most PR systems, the politicians are relatively free of direct obligations and connections to their constituents, and they don't do the same kind of constituency work that is common in plurality systems. Representation of parties and various groups. Well, this is an area in which PR systems are very good. They're very strong. It's part of the point to make sure that parties are equally or fairly represented. So by any standards, they rank very high. And, of course, we've talked a little bit before about that capacity then to increase the number of different groups. We saw, for instance, that women are elected in larger numbers in PR systems. That's because, of course, party leaders who control the list can say, well, we want to try and improve that situation, so we're going to put more on the list. So they've got that kind of direct capacity to provide for representation of groups as the parties see appropriate, whatever those groups might be. Democratic political parties, do these systems, what do they do to political parties? Well, they increase the number of them by saying, look, if you can win a few votes, you can get a few seats. That increases the propensity of people to contest. That creates more political parties. And there's no doubt that in proportional representation systems, there are more parties contesting the elections and there are more parties getting elected. In some sense, that's part of the point of the system. People have, if they're not happy in their own political party, they can start their own. And as long as they can carry some support with them, they know they can get returned and maybe have some influence in the parliamentary process. Maybe more influence as a leader of a small party if they hold a critical balance of power than they might even have if they were in a larger party. Most bargaining takes place between parties, and these parties tend to be more centralized, more bureaucratized. Because there are more and because they're kind of carving out their own clientele, they often are more ideological, saying, look, this is what we stand for, support us, and we'll go forward, rather than trying to span a broad spectrum. Evaluation for voters, the second group of evaluations we had talked about. Well, the amount of choice that voters have varies a lot by ballot structure. But it's moderate or it's poor compared to the majority and plurality kinds of systems that we've had in other places. You know, the color is quite different on these two screens, isn't it? I don't know what that's about. Representation. By here, we were really talking about, is there a kind of an identifiable representation? Do politicians represent a defined constituency? Well, the electoral districts are generally too large to have that kind of meaningful personal representation in these kinds of systems. There are few electoral incentives for individual politicians to service individual voters. That's not what these systems are about. So on balance, we might say poor. Encouragement to participate? Well, it's true that the complicated formulas we talked about earlier don't make these systems necessarily so transparent, but at the end of the day, you can see exactly what's happened. The party got so many votes and it got about that number of seats, and so there's a kind of clarity at that sort of level. And in some sense, that makes it very clear to voters what the value of their votes are. More votes for a party is going to get them more seats.
That doesn't happen in our kind of systems. More parties may mean there's more choice, although it may not be, it's a different kind of choice because it's maybe not a choice of governments. And we know that voter turnouts are slightly higher in proportional representation. Remember, Andre said 2 to 5%. So on balance, you would have to say that they seem to be fairly good at encouraging participation. And finally, in terms of the equality of the vote, the last of those categories we had talked about, I think we would want to say it's good. Most votes contribute to electing somebody. You know, we don't have situations in which 60% of the voters' votes don't contribute to electing anybody. Almost all of them contribute in some way or another. And the closer you get to pure proportionality, of course, the clearer you get to a situation where all votes are counting equally. So on that criteria, it's good. Well, in summary then, to come back to this kind of little template we've been using, some of the strengths and weaknesses. Well, the strengths of these systems are that the party's presence reflects their, in the legislature, reflects their support in the country. That ought to be a major strength for this kind of system. You kind of get what you earn, a kind of fair principle. It increases the number of parties that are able to compete. And if you think competition is a good thing, more choice is a good thing, that on balance, maybe this is a strength of the system too. Smaller parties are able to get into parliament. They may 10, 12, 15%. I mean, small parties might be 10 or 15 or 20%. In our kind of system, they often don't get any seats. These kind of parties do get their voices heard in the legislature because they're able to elect some members. So minority voices or voices of not majority groups can be heard. Most votes contribute to electing somebody. Strengthens the role of parliament with respect to the government. So parliament has some way of kind of keeping the government on at least some kind of rein. Never quite clear how short or long it is, but at least it's on some kind of rein in the way that governments and other systems not necessarily are. And voter turnout seems to be somewhat higher. So all those would appear, in terms of the kind of criteria we've been talking about, to be real strengths of proportional representation systems. Well, what about some of the weaknesses? Well, in some sense, they're the obverse, right? We're just kind of turning the coin over. It doesn't produce one-party governments that are identifiable that you get to choose at election time. And if you think one-party government that's able to plan, say, this is what we're going to do, get elected, and then do it, you think that's the kind of model that's best, you can't get that with proportional representation systems. Well, it leads to proliferation of minor parties. One person's strength, lots of choices, another person's nuisances, right? So if you think lots of small parties, if you want all 41 that are currently registered elections BC to be kind of out there on the ballot paper, it's good. But if you think that, you know, they're just getting in the way, they're just extraneous noise, then you would think that isn't a good thing. Elections don't provide clear choices of governments, generally speaking. Where coalitions kind of become semi-permanent coalition arrangements, then they get closer to looking like choices of governments, but they're not choices in quite the same way. These systems don't produce local representatives of the kind that we're used to in first-past-the-post, single-member plurality kind of systems. Members are elected for regions, but they don't have that kind of personal connection or obligation to them. And, of course, individual politicians can't be held responsible by voters. So those are, in some sense, the consequences of having a system that produces all the other strengths that we talked about a minute or two ago. Well, when we want a PR system in British Columbia, what might it look like? I did a very simple kind of guesstimation, and we have a much more sophisticated one I'll tell you about in a minute. And I took the last two elections in British Columbia, and these are just the percentages, the proportions. And in 1996, the Liberals got 44% of the seats in the legislature, and the Democrats got 56%. We know, of course, that's not how the votes were shared out. In 2001, the Liberals got 97% of the seats, and the New Democrats got 3%. Now, if we had a proportional representation system, and if the same parties had been running, and if the same voters had voted the same way, a lot of big ifs, and if there had been a 2% threshold, the distributions in the legislature would have looked like that. So if you'd had a proportional representation system, same parties, same voters, 2% threshold, you would have had in 1996 a legislature with 42% Liberal, 40% New Democrats, 6% Progressive Democrat. What is PD? I can't remember what. Progressive Democratic Alliance was Gordon Wilson, and the Reform Party would have had 10% of the seats. You can see what it would have been in 2001, 58-22, 12 Green, 3 Unity, 3 Marijuana Party. Well, those would have been very different looking legislatures. There wouldn't have been a majority government in 1996. And it certainly wouldn't have been a new Democratic Party majority government, which is what our system produced. The Liberals would have been the largest party in the legislature. There would have been four significant parties playing a role. The Liberals probably would have got the first chance to form a government. That's generally how it would have worked. But the New Democrats might have got a chance to hang on because they were the outgoing government. The Liberals might have formed a minority government, or they might have formed a coalition, I suppose, with either the PDA, probably not likely given the relationship between the Gordons in 1996, but that wouldn't have given them a majority. So you would have had a coalition, but you still wouldn't have got a majority, so you say, well, there's not a lot in that. They might have formed a majority coalition with Reform. So you could have had a Liberal minority, a Liberal PDA minority, or a Liberal Reform majority. On the other hand, you could have had an NDP Reform majority. That would have given them half the votes. I don't know. You could have had an NDP-PDA coalition, because if Reform refused to have anything to do with the Liberals, and they say, well, we're not getting into bed with them, then the NDP and PDA might have come together and said, well, we can have 46, which is bigger than either 40 or 10, so we could have had a minority coalition. So you could have had that kind of possibility. Or the Liberals and New Democrats could have said, the PDA and the Reform are all turkeys. We don't have anything to do with any of those people. Well, we're going to form a coalition of the two big parties. And this sometimes happens in Europe. They're called the grand coalitions. And we've had grand coalitions with sometimes two big parties with as much as 80 or 85% of the votes as a way of forming a government because the other alternatives were unpalatable. And there have been grand coalitions in Germany when the Socialists and the Christian Democrats, two huge parties, about 40% of the vote each, came together because they wanted to exclude or the other kind of combinations just weren't going to work out. So there would have been a host of different kind of possibilities, and the government we would have got would have depended on the kind of bargaining and calculations that would have gone on. But all four of those parties, they would have reflected that strength and the views of British Columbians. 10% of British Columbians said they wanted Reform. 6% said they wanted PDA. And so their voices would have been heard in that process somewhere. Clearly, that was a government that would have been checked much more closely by the legislature. The government wouldn't have been able to get away with some of the things that it probably did. That might or may not have been a good thing. In 2001, we would have had a very different legislature. The Liberals still would have had a majority because they did what parties rarely do. One party gets the majority of the votes. They would have had 58% of the seats. But there would have been a much stronger opposition. It would have been a fragmented opposition between four parties, between the NDP, the Greens, Unity, and Marijuana. They all would have had some kind of say, but they wouldn't have been able to check. They wouldn't have had the influence on the government that much smaller parties might have had in the previous legislature. Given that majority of the Liberal government could have done pretty much as it wanted and done good things like set up assemblies. But two big ifs up there, eh? And they're probably unrealistic. Because if we'd had a PR system, probably more parties would have run. And if people knew it was a PR system, people might have voted differently. More people might have voted for the PDA in 1996, for instance. A lot of people probably liked Gordon Wilson and his party, but said, well, they're not going to win, so I'm not going to waste my vote. I'm going to vote either for the Liberals or the New Democrats. That's my real choice. But suddenly, if you realize that, wait a minute, they're going to get as many seats as they get votes, people's calculations would change and their voting behavior would change. So the trouble is, when you do these kind of scenarios, the ifs are awfully big. And if we had taken off the 2% threshold rule, the Greens would have won some parties in 1996. The reason they've got a line is because I just arbitrarily said, let's have a kind of 2% threshold. Well, you've got on your table in front of you a chart that came yesterday by email to me, a wonderful chart that David Wills calculated. David's right down here. Wave to the crowd, David. And he said, I'm going to try and figure out these systems. And what he actually did was look at
five different PR systems with three different district magnitudes for 1996 and 2001. And you can see they all produce slightly different kind of results. If we'd used a same party, same voters, he couldn't mess with those big ifs. But if both of those things held, and he has no threshold in here, if he'd had a district magnitude of 75, which was the size of the legislature in 1996, and he used a hair quota with a district magnitude of the province as a whole, the Liberals would have had 32 seats, the Greens would have had 2, the New Democrats would have had 30, the PDA would have had 4, and the Reform Party 7. And you can see that under different combinations of these quotas we talked about, and these formulas we talked about, and these district managers we talked about, you would have had different results. Now, they don't differ radically. They don't differ as much between them as they do from, he's got a column called Candidates Elected, the third column of numbers, basically. That was the real results. So that's what we got under a plurality system. And you can see that any of the other variations are much, amongst themselves, are tiny compared to the variations with the kind of plurality system we have. So it's a very kind of useful way of kind of looking at the range of possibilities with the big ifs always in the background. Well, any questions about any of that? I'm sure you've got dozens of them, and we can talk about them in some of the small groups, but if there's a couple before we break, why don't we do that? Bill?
Simple question, I hope. Under the PR system, have any of the governments or any of the nations using it ever produced a majority government?
I'm loath to say no, because I'm sure there's some example out there somewhere. But I can't think of one off the top of my head, not on a PR list system. The proportional representation single transferable vote systems can produce majority governments, and Campbell will talk about those this afternoon, and they're a little bit more common under those systems. I can't think of a PR list system off the top of my head, but I'm sure there must be one somewhere, because there always is, right? But almost never.
Just maybe two more. Julie and David had their hands up. And Shoney, I'll save you till after lunch.
Julie?
I had two questions. One, the very first one perhaps is a simple one. Going back to the PR systems where you were listing the four countries, Israel and Holland, et cetera. What happens, my first question is, what happens during the period of time where they're organizing their coalition? How is the government run? And the second question I had, kept tweaking in the back of my mind, is how do countries, first of all, decide how many representatives there are going to be in Parliament? What, number one. Number two is, when you look at the example about Sweden and this two-tier situation that they have, and how many members would be in each tier, and the different thresholds, the reasons. Sweden just looks like an interesting situation, and we sort of flew over it, and I wondered if we were going to have an opportunity to discuss that or to understand that a little bit better. But
first question about what happens. Typically what happens is the previous government will stay in office until a new one is formed. In these situations, they behave like so-called caretaker governments. There's an agreement that you don't do big changes, you don't do policy. Parliament usually isn't meeting. The politicians are bargaining, trying to form a government, and then they'll meet Parliament. And, of course, since Parliament isn't meeting, they can't pass new laws and so on. But basically the assumption is, as a kind of caretaker, you're kind of minding the store, you're making sure things get done, but you're not doing new things or innovating. And different systems have kind of complicated arrangements for how the coalition bargaining process takes place. Like, who starts it? Who gets the first crack at trying to create a coalition and so on? One of the roles that in the Netherlands, for instance, the monarch has a kind of role to kind of formally appoint someone to begin the kind of coalition bargaining kind of process. Other countries use different kinds of arrangements. But basically, it's a kind of caretaker situation. How do you decide how many members? These things have evolved kind of historically over time. They're pretty arbitrary. There's a fair range of answers. It doesn't seem to be any easy decision as to why one country decides they want a parliament of 300 and another one wants one of 600. You know, they reflect kind of traditions in the way these countries were put together. And most of Europe, we think of them as simple countries, but they have long histories of deep regional variations. You know, 400 years ago, there was probably 500 political units in Western Europe. And over the last three or four centuries, they've been kind of squished together into kind of in Western Europe, you know, 20 countries or whatever they are. But all those original bits and pieces have kind of historical legacies, and often they're kind of just built into those kind of notions. And some parliaments have some areas that are overrepresented for historical reasons. There are more Scots in the parliament in London than there ought to be because of these kind of, well. for these kind of historical anomaly reasons. The last question was about the Swedish case. Well, like any of them, it reflects a kind of series of experimentations and variations, making different compromises over time. Very few of these systems get put in place and then are stable. I mean, in the sense that, well, they'll start with the Saint-Legout formula for a while, and then something will come up. They'll say, well, we want to just kind of fudge it a little bit. So then they'll change the formula, or they'll change a quota, or they'll decide, well, we've got a few more corrective seats, and these things kind of get built on like layers, accretion, and just kind of build up, and then you get systems that look like the ones we have. It's not that they necessarily, all those pieces were put together in one deliberate decision. They often reflect a series of decisions over time. David? Mike?
Farrell in his book describes various forms of open lists, some which where the open list has some influence on the way the candidates are sequenced, but others where, in fact, it's the determinant about how the candidates are selected once the party is, the votes are counted for the party. I'm thinking of the Swiss system, I believe. In a truly open list, where the votes for the individuals in the list impact who gets elected, does that make a significant difference in the way the elected representative interacts with the constituency, and does it have any significant impact on party discipline?
I think I would say no and yes. Probably doesn't have a great deal of impact on the relationship with the constituency, because the constituency may be the country as a whole. Because in some sense, it's the votes of all the country for all the candidates that get you a seat that then you're able to fill. It does have a considerable impact on party discipline, because you don't owe your seat. You owe your seat to the party winning some seats, but you don't owe it to anybody in the party. You owe it to the party's voters who chose you. And so some party boss didn't put you at the top. 100,000 voters may have given you a preference as opposed to some other party candidate. So clearly the capacity to centralize the party machine is not as great. If you control people's political careers, you've got a real powerful tool for discipline and control in a party organization. That's going to be much more disciplined, much more centralized. And if you don't have that, because you can't influence which of your members are going to get elected or re-elected, then you don't have anywhere near the same kind of discipline. Certainly a list system where people know that if they offend the leader, they're going to be dropped way down the list, not excluded, just dropped down the list to a place where they can't possibly win. That's a very powerful tool for party leaders to discipline their supporters. So I think those kind of systems do make a fair amount of impact on what's possible. Now, all parties have their own cultures and traditions that are also part of that story, but that institutional rule is significant, and you've hit an important point. Okay, well, you've survived some tough PR stuff. We'll have a coffee break, and if you have any really, really hard questions, please ask the facilitators. They're ready.
Thanks, Ken.